Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone to our second in the mini topic of what we've been referring to as the rules, the halachas of kashrus dealing with the outside world, which is a euphemism that we've been using for various halachas which deal with kashrus when we have a non-Jew involved. So last week, in the first year, we discussed various halachas which we have to be aware of when we have a non-Jew in our house. For example, I'll just run through them very quickly. One is yichud, that if there is, let's say, in many times in our settings, there's a non-Jewish woman and she's working in our house, so then obviously you have a problem if you're alone, if a man, let's say the husband is alone with her, or there's a male child who's above a certain age who's alone with that woman, so that could be a problem. The second area is Shabbos. Second area is Shabbos. Everybody thinks that you could tell a guy to do anything and everything for a Jewish family on Shabbos, which is not true. A third area, again, we're just recapping very quickly. Third area is Yontif, and again, besides what a goy is and is not allowed to do for a Jewish family on Yontif, there's the additional issue that you're not allowed to invite a non-Jew to eat at your house on Yontif. On Shabbos, that's okay. The reason, again, is because you're only allowed to cook for a Jew. On Shabbos, you're not allowed to cook, so there's no problem. But on Yontif, you're allowed to cook, but you're only allowed to cook for a Jew. So therefore, Chazal said that if you invite a goy, a non-Jew, so then the problem is maybe you'll make more for them. And if you make more for them, then you're cooking for a non-Jew. You're not allowed to do that on Yontif. Again, and we got into the side issue that this comes up in more situations than we realize, because sometimes there's somebody in a community who's studying to be Jewish, but they're not Jewish yet. They're a potential ger. And people want to invite that person, so that's a problem. Then the last area which we discussed last week is Bashar Shini Salamina Ayin, which is the whole issue of a non-Jew being in possession of food, of meat. For the classic example is a guy making a delivery from a kosher restaurant or a kosher caterer or whatever it may be, and the guy has possession of meat and the meat is unsealed. So what we're worried about is maybe the meat was switched. And this is not a chumrah, this is a black and white halacha. And again, this could be a problem whether you have a non-Jewish woman in your house. Or again, we branched off into the area of non-Jews making a delivery. And that the food has to be sealed in some way, shape, or form to ensure that it's what left the kitchen at either at the caterer or the restaurant or whatever, or by a friend, is what you indeed received. Now, what I didn't mention last week is there's an interesting tshuva by Rav Moshe in Igros Moshe Chelak Aleph of Yordea, Simon Samach Aleph, when the where Rav Moshe discusses that the person should be careful not to leave a goya alone in their house, because again, various things can go wrong. Washing dishes could happen. Food could be switched. You know, you don't know what happens. Now, again, the idea here is not to leave them alone. Means you don't have to stand over them all the time. But one idea is they should always think that there's a Jew there or might be there. And the example or the way that I tell people to stay within the realms of this halacha is, a lot of times when you have a cleaning lady or something like that, and you leave, you tell them, I'll be back in 2 hours. I'll be back in 3 hours. I'll be back at 3 o'clock. That's not good. Because then they know that they have a certain amount of time that they have free rein. And that could be potentially disastrous. Another, something could happen, and they're not going to tell you. They'll be too embarrassed, whatever the case may be. So the best thing to do is either leave and not tell them, or if they see you leaving, say, I'll be back soon. Soon is relative. Soon could be a day. Soon could be 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. Again, it has to be realistic. And obviously, if they know they see your bags are packed and you're going to the airport, and you know, so that's a problem, obviously. But that's usually not the case in most of our situations. So again, there should always be this, so to speak, fear, what we call in halakha mirsas, a fear or some level of reality that a Jew could come anytime. Again, maybe another family member could come in anytime. Can we discuss this a little last week when we were talking about yichud, that the Chazon Ish has a tshuva about yichud, that there's a leniency in yichud if somebody could come anytime. When someone has a key, maybe it's another family member, they could come in anytime. So again, it's a similar idea that if the señorita could come back at any second, or maybe somebody from the family could come in at any second, so then again, there's a little more, and this realistically is true, somebody will indeed won't pop in at any time. So then there's more of a fear. Again, this is one of the ideas we discussed at the end of last week, which makes the kashrus world, the hashgacha world, go around. In other words, the whole idea is there might not be a Jew there all the time, but a Jew could come anytime. We were discussing that at the end of last week, like the hashgacha on water, on Arrowhead water, or a crystal geyser. So the idea is obviously there's not a Jew there all the time. There's maybe not a need for it, but there is a fear that a Jew could show up anytime. Right? The mashgichim try to show up at irregular intervals. Obviously, if they show up at regular intervals, the guy knows that the mashgiach is going to show up 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the first of every month. That's a problem, because if they know that. But again, what they try to do is make it irregular intervals. Then the concept is that the Jew could show up any time, and who knows? And people are scared of Murphy's Law, just why I'm trying to do something and sneak around the hashgacha, they'll show up. Then that's something that we rely upon, that there's a fear because somebody could show up at any time. That's good. So for today, I wanted to get into one of the another area of halacha dealing with a non-Jew, and that's what we call bishul akum. Bishul akum. Bishul akum. That's the way I make my lamads. Bishul akum. That means cooking by a goy. Yes, Mrs. Schenker.
I'm sorry.
That's
okay. What about people who have a goy that watches their kids all day and they go to work? The goy knows that they
don't know. Time
every day.
Again, I don't know. It's a problem. That's what Rav Moshe doesn't write specifically about that. But again, the idea is there. In other words, if a goy thinks they have free reign over the kitchen, can do whatever they want, you got to worry. Rav Moshe writes that you should leave the dishes for 24 hours. You should leave the kelim for 24 hours so that they become eino ben yomo. So then it's not less of a problem. A lot of people don't know this. This is a big bone of contention amongst people who follow Rav Moshe, that everybody knows the leniencies of Rav Moshe. But things where he's a little more strict, people don't know that at all. So, but again, I'm not saying you shouldn't hold Rav Moshe, obviously. From me, you're not going to hear that. But people have to be aware, at least of the concept that Rav Moshe is making. That is, if the non-Jew has willy-nilly control over the kitchen or the house, that's for sure there's problems. You might not be aware of it. We'll see when we get to Bishul Akum. Okay, let's get into Bishul Akum a little bit. Now, we're going to be discussing, again, as the topic, as I mentioned before, we're going to be talking about a number of different topics as we go through the next few weeks of halachas dealing with goyim. And the idea is basically the same. That is, there are various takanas de rabbanim, various rules that Chazal made, which are not chumras. There are legitimate derabbanans. So in other words, if you're careful not to drink milk with chicken, so this is about the same thing. It's a takana derabbanan, the Chazal made by food. And that is, the Chazal wanted to ensure that when we go into galus, when we go into exile, so we're going to have dealings with non-Jews, and obviously non-Jews might be preparing our food or whatever the case may be, So Chazal were worried about two things. And that will be a theme that will go through the next few weeks. That's Chazal were worried about two things. Number one, that we're worried about kashrus. They were worried about maybe that, as we all know, as sincere as a goy might be, as a non-Jew might be, but still, you know, for them, they might not know the halachas as well as we do. Even if they do, there's still, for us, we know that we're going to have to give a dim cheshbon. We're going to have to give an account for the fact if we eat something that's not kosher. A non-Jew, they don't have that same fear. They don't have that same concept. They don't have that concept. So therefore, it doesn't mean the same to them as it does to us. So the first area that Chazal were worried about is kashrus. In other words, that if you have a goy making some food, so it could be that whether they know it or they don't, they'll make a mistake. And thereby, we, when we consume that food, will be eating not kosher food. That's the first area Chazal were worried about. The second area that Chazal were worried about, and this is maybe the more famous one, is what we call chasnus. Chasnus, as you can see the word chatan in there, it means intermarriage. Intermarriage. We in America should be keenly aware of this. And that is that Chazal were scared, and we'll see this going through the various halakhas that we will go through, that Chazal were scared that food is very important. We all know how important food is for Jews, especially Jews. So if a goy prepares our food, or we'll see this in Meir Sashem when we get to bread, things like that. So we're scared that Jews are going to have a lot of interaction with non-Jews. And what is that going to lead to? Well, all of a sudden you have an O'Brien marrying a Schwartz. You have an or a Silverman, right? I forgot who the speaker was, but a number of years ago I heard that this person said that in the 60s or even in the 50s and the 60s, when you'd read the wedding announcements in the New York Times, you'd very rarely see a Silverman marrying a Schwartz. Now, unfortunately, as we know, it's more than rampant. Like in the Kiruv Weira world, they talk about the silent Holocaust, about how many people, unfortunately, were losing because of intermarriage. So Chazal obviously knew what they were talking about. This is based upon what happened to Klal Yisrael, Baal Peor, with Pinchas and that whole thing with Zimri. So again, we have to be careful of, even though we have to be cordial and we have to have dealings with non-Jews because that's where we are, we're in Golos, but there has to be some type of safeguard to make sure we don't go too far. As we know, the bracha that Bilam gave the Jewish people was Heim Am Levadad Yishkan, that they're a nation that's separate. That even when we are with the non-Jews, we're separate. We eat separately. We do things separately. We see this by Yosef and the Mitzrim. And when the brothers ate with Yosef, the Mitzrim ate separate. They didn't eat with the Jews. So we see that concept going all the way back. So therefore, Chazal enacted, because of these two reasons. Again, the first reason is kashrus, which I didn't write on the board. And the second reason is because of chasnus, because of intermarriage. As we go through the subtopics in the next few weeks, we'll see sometimes there was more of a stress on one over the other. Sometimes in a mini topic, there was more of a stress on kashrus. Sometimes there was more of a stress on intermarriage. We'll see as we go through. Now, so therefore the first topic, which we're going to discuss in Meir Sashem tonight, is the idea of Bishul Akum. So the halacha is pretty simple, if there is such a thing. And that is that if a goy, a non-Jew, cooked something for a Jew, that food, now you have to make this very clear, that could be all of the ingredients, all the pots, all the utensils, everything were 100% kosher. But just the mere act that a goy cooked something for a Jew makes the food not kosher. And it's worse than that. We'll see at the end, not only is the food not kosher, but the pots and the utensils that were used to make that food are also not kosher. It's not just the food's not kosher, but the utensils are not kosher either. So this is huge. This is very big. So again, the basic idea is If a goy should cook for a non-Jew, even if you know that hypothetically everything was kosher, a very simple example. Again, we're talking about the most prevalent situation we have is is that there's a non-Jewish woman who works for a Jew. Could be this non-Jewish woman has been working for this Jew for many, many years, and she sees the senorita make Shabbos for years, and she helps, we'll get into that, her prepare Shabbos food for years. So all of a sudden she sees that the woman's coming home late, so she figures she'll do her a favor. She knows how to make a filter fish. She knows how to make challah. She knows how to, challah again is different, it's bread. But again, she makes an entire Shabbos meal, and it's absolutely fantastic. Now again, she made it in the Jew's house. So she only used kosher ingredients. She only used kosher pots. And let's say she didn't mess up carne and leche, milchiks and fleishiks. She didn't mess that up. Well, somehow you know. So everything seems to be 100% fine. It's 100% terrible. It's 100% treif because it is bishul akum. It's food that was cooked by a non-Jew. Okay, here comes the buts. Here comes the buts. The way Chazal set up this issur d'rabbanan is under two criterion. In other words, it's not anything that a goy cooked is bishul akum. Chazal made parameters and guidelines that only certain foods were concerned if they are bishul akum, if not. And basically, there are two guidelines that we go by. Whether a given food is a problem of bishul akum or if it is not. Number one is raw, meaning, I have to be very careful with this because throughout my years in Beis Yaakov, gets a little confusing, so I try to make it as clear as possible. And that is, if the food, whatever the food is, could be eaten raw, or is normally eaten raw, let me put it that way, we could eat almost anything raw, right? You could eat, chicken raw, you can eat a steak raw, you could do anything. But again, we're talking about that normal human beings eat this thing raw. So then, if a goy cooked it, it is not a problem. It is not a problem of bishul akum. Very simple to understand this. In other words, if a goy cooked something, but really they didn't have to cook it, I could eat it raw. So what did they really do for me? They really didn't do that much for me because I didn't need them to cook it. I could have eaten it as it was. No problem. Okay? So if there's a food that could be eaten raw, or is normally eaten raw, I should say. And again, we'll get into this. Let me just tell you the two, and then we'll dissect it a little more. So if the food could be eaten raw, so then that food is not bishul akum. The other idea, the other criteria is that in order for a food to be bishul akum, it has to be a food that's ole al shulchan malachim. It has to be a food that, so to speak, goes up on a king's table. Meaning that let's say the food cannot be eaten raw. Let's say it can't. So they did something for me. Right? They made a food which is normally inedible, edible. Thank you very much. But still, that food might not be a problem of bishul akum if it is a food, we look at it again and we say, is this food a food that's ola al shulchan malachim? This food as it is, is it a food that goes up on a king's table? Meaning that again, you might have cooked something for me, but if it's not a, as we call, chashuv food, if it's not an important food, so you're right, it might be that I cannot eat it raw, but it's not such an important food. So how much do they really do for me? So therefore, the idea is, how much connection is there going to be? You did me a favor, but not a big favor. You cooked for me something that's not so important. It's not so important. It wouldn't be served to a king. So again, I hopefully trying to clarify this, right? In other words, the idea is there going to be a bond between me and that person? Well, if they cook something that I could eat raw, so then it's not a problem. Even if they did cook it, again, I don't need you. I could have eaten it the way it was, really. Number two is, even if it could not be eaten raw, but if it's a food that wouldn't be served at a king's table, so then, again, you did something for me, but nothing so great because it's not such a great food. It's not an important food. It's not, as we say, a study food. It's just, you know, just a regular food. So it's not so... So therefore, Chazal said that would not be bishlachim. So again, in order, let's put it this way, in order for a given food to be a problem of bishlachim, it has to be that it cannot be eaten raw, and the food is a food that could go up on a king's table. Everybody got that? That's where people get confused. Has to be a food that cannot be eaten raw, has to be a food that can or would go up on a king's table. Then you have that the goy did something very significant for you. They gave you a food that's significant. Okay? Now let's get into this a little more. Now, first of all, we'll go to number two first. Everybody might be wondering, like, Olal Shulchan Malachim, what does that mean? I don't see any kings around. I really don't. So the question is, who's a melech? So believe it or not, that, as we'll see soon, this is one of the disputes that a hashgacha, different hashgachas have. What is the concept of Olal Shulchan Malachim? What's the criteria, the guidelines for Olal Shulchan Malachim? Some hashgachas, I know a hashgacha which takes this literally. In other words, there is a hashgacha, a very reliable hashgacha, I never like to mention who, that calls President Bush's cook and asks him, would, or it might be a her problem, I think it's a him, would you serve this at a state dinner? Would you serve this at a state dinner? Now we'll get this a little later in a second to see why this is important. Some say that the meal of a king is a wedding, right? Chasen and Kal is like a king and a queen. So some people say that. Now you realize that could make a difference sometimes, because maybe they once served it at George W. Bush's state dinner, but for a wedding, maybe they would. Okay, probably not. That's probably not a big problem. But let's go back and a little more and try to clarify these two things a little more, and you see where we do get into problems. Let's go back on these criteria. Okay, so now we understand what a melech is. It's either the president. Again, if you live in England, it's maybe a little easier. But again, so now I think we have basic idea. Could something be eaten raw if something served at a state dinner, at an important dinner? Okay, but let's go back on this, and you'll see why this seems to be a very simple halacha. Is a food eaten raw? Is a food something served at a state dinner? Well, let's go back and slowly on this. Okay, let's go back to raw. Could something be eaten raw? So what do? We go by society, what people generally do. But you have to realize that's not so simple. Let me give you an example. A great example, I think. And that is carrots. Carrots. Now, if you speak to somebody from Europe and you speak to them and you offer them a carrot, like a raw carrot, they look at you like, what are you offering me? Because in Europe, and I've spoken to people from Europe, they would never eat carrots raw. Animals eat carrots raw. That's why an old traditional Yanta food is tzimis, cooked carrots. But older Jews would not eat carrots raw, never do such a thing. So now, I don't know, in this crowd, I don't know if we want to take a poll, but I think maybe a lot of people eat carrots raw, right? Either in a salad, or you just munch on carrots. Something that I think you can buy at Trader Joe's is they have these little packets of carrots that are peeled and washed, and there's a few carrots, and you could put it in lunch for your kids, very nutritious and everything like that. You know, kids eat carrots raw all the time. So now the question would be to Hashgacha is, let's say if a non-Jew made simis, Would that be bishlachim? Or would it not? I'm not looking at criteria number two, olo shochem lachem. Let's just stick with number one. In other words, is this a food that we say is eaten raw? Or is it a food that people eat raw? Did it change? Some places, somewhere, at some point in time, if you say, yeah, it's a food that is eaten raw, society, most people in society do eat carrots raw, will change, because in Europe, for sure, they didn't eat carrots raw. So it changed. When did it change? Who did it change? Did it really change? Somebody told me they were driving towards San Diego, and they got hungry, and they pulled over. There was a vegetable stand, and they were selling corn. And they bought the corn, and the person said, you could eat this corn raw.
The sweet one, the white sweet one.
Maybe, I don't know. But I don't know, I just feel weird eating corn raw. I don't know, it just seemed weird to me. So now, so what do you say? If a goy cooked corn, so is that bishwakum? Is it not? Where do you divide that? This is tricky, believe it or not. It's not so clear. And again, as I told you at the beginning, one of the things I hope people will go away with a greater appreciation of is that when somebody gives a hashkacha, it's not just ingredients. There's somebody, there has to be somebody there who's paskening shilas about what is our standard. Let me give you another example. Let's go to number two. Ola al shulchan malachim. Something goes up on a king's table. Okay, so again, as we discussed before, what does that mean? George W. Bush? Does it mean Queen Elizabeth? Does it mean a chasen kal? Okay, whatever you want to say it is. Okay? So, but still, where do you divide that? Let me give you an example. Potato chips. Are potato chips a problem of bishul akum or not? So, what are potato chips? Potato chips are sliced potatoes. Potatoes can't be eaten raw, last I know. So that's, number one's out. So number two, well, are potato chips olo shulchan malachim? Again, we're not talking about what George W. Bush and Laura do when they sneak down to the kitchen and grab something to eat late at night. You know, we're not talking about that. We're talking about at a king's dinner. In other words, when Putin comes, or Queen Elizabeth comes, or Olmert comes, or whatever, and they have a steak dinner with the tuxes and everything, what is on the menu? So you say, well, then it's obvious, right? The potato chips don't qualify. Okay, let's say we go with that. So then what's the, how about if you have roasted potatoes? Roasted potatoes. What are roasted potatoes? You take a potato, you slice it up, and you roast it. So why is that different than a potato chip? Oh, one you deep fry and one you roast. Is that a difference? So believe it or not, this is something most people don't know. There's a difference in hashkachas, what you hold as far as this is concerned. Let me give you an example. For example, Lay's potato chips. So the hashkacha, I'm pretty sure about this, or most regular potato chips, the hashkacha holds that's not a problem of bishul akum. So what? So therefore, they have to worry about the oil, they have to worry about the potatoes, but they don't basically have to have a mashgiach there basically all the time. You'll see how this plays out later. The, as we call it, the Hamisha brands, like, I don't know, like Blooms and Liebers and all those other types, they have a chasisha, a Hamisha hashkacha, as we call it. So they say, what difference is there between a potato chip and a roasted potato? Everybody would say a roasted potato is a problem of bishul akum. It's served at a state dinner, served at a chasana, served at whatever. So there's no, or not enough of a difference between a roasted potato and a potato chip. Therefore, they hold it's a problem of bishul akum, and we'll see how that plays out. Okay? So basically what I'm saying is, what you have to appreciate is with this, both of these criteria for bishul akum, they're very nebulous. I mean, not very nebulous, but there's some play here on both of them, and people, you're relying upon the hashgacha what the standard they have for these things. Now, again, if they're lenient, there's legitimacy to that. There's definitely legitimacy to, you can hear in all these cases. But there has to be somebody very reliable answering these shilas as to how are we going to run our hashgacha, what's going to be the standard. And that's something we all have to appreciate. It has to be, like I said before, this is where the girls used to get mixed up. It has to be, in order for it to be a problem of bishlachim, it has to be a food that cannot be eaten raw and is ola shulchan malachim. It has to be both. It has to be both. If it's one or the other, it's not a problem. So, for example, a potato, roasted potatoes, is that a problem? Let's say Juanita made roasted potatoes. That would be a problem. I would think, again, you, right? Potatoes cannot be eaten raw, and they would be served at a state dinner, I would dare say. Juanita made chicken. Juanita made steak. Juanita made, if Juanita made a hot dog, right? Would that be a problem with Bishlachim? Most would say no. But believe it or not, some say it is a problem. Why? Because what's a hot dog? At least a kosher hot dog is mostly meat. So meat is olah shulchan malachim. Some other people I've discussed this with say, yeah, but I don't know if you'd eat it that way. People do. But again, we go by what most people. And there's another problem with a hot dog also, that maybe a hot dog wouldn't be served, but a pig in a blanket would. Okay, it's an hors d'oeuvre. So then they wouldn't serve it at, maybe at the thing, but they'd serve it as an hors d'oeuvre. Is that olah shulchan malachim? Right, you're standing outside mingling. I don't know if they do this before a state dinner, and there's their erech hasna. They definitely have it, right? And they're passing hors d'oeuvres. Okay, but that's only a pig in a blanket, but not the pig. I mean, part of the right? Not the hot dog. Well, does that make enough of a difference? So again, this is a problem. This is a problem. Would you say a hot dog is a problem? Can't be in raw. Is olah shulchan malachim? Is that considered that's olah shulchan malach, that they pass it at as an hors d'oeuvre before a wedding? Is that considered it's going up on a king's table? It's not really going up on a king's table, but it's an hors d'oeuvre. Is that enough?
What about your carrot?
So that's what I'm saying. Most people today would say carrots are not a problem. But you can understand people saying, yes, it is a problem. Because we only care, you know, like maybe more Hamish people would say, you know, never eat a carrot raw. You know, like you could hear some people saying that. Okay. Now, so that's the, yeah, I'm sorry.
What about fish that can be eaten raw since now,
right, like
in
sushi?
LA it's so common?
Yeah, so maybe that, I would dare say that's only a certain type of fish. Like if you have a gefilte fish, and you know, especially those loaves, and you know, Juanita makes it, I don't think anybody would eat that raw, I would dare say. You're right. I would probably think that, well, see, by sushi, they're not cooking, right? That's the whole idea. So it's not a problem.
But
here, obviously, they have to be doing something. What?
It's a fish. I'm just wondering, in terms of the change, the possibility of altering the criteria.
Right.
If a boy does cook a piece of halibut,
right, and you could get halibut sushi,
right,
so that would have to be something that a rav would consider. Again, you get into problems of, well, maybe in Los Angeles they do, but how about everywhere else, right? I remember when the restaurant was open across the street, so I was speaking to another rav, and we said, you know, we have pizza based medrash, and a couple years ago we had deli based medrash. So I was standing outside, and he was asking me something, you know, what new pro? So he said, well, what are you you're running out of foods. What are you going to do next? So I looked across, he said, sushi. Ah, sushi basement. You know, maybe we'll do that. You know, like, you know, so, but you talk to people in other cities, sushi. Okay, so these are issues. Okay, so let's just get back to, we're pretty clear. Again, most of the times we don't have problems with what is considered something that cannot be eaten raw and is all goes up on a shulchan melech. Like most of the things we deal with, like chicken and meat and things like that, that would be a problem, right? That would be a problem. I don't want to get into bread because bread is a separate Takana Durabon called Pasakum, which is a separate issue. So I don't want to get into that right now. Just talking about foods other than something that's baked, something that's bread-like. Okay, so now I see Mrs. Cohn looking at me quizzically, and I assume that the reason why she's looking at me like that, I mean, there could be a lot of reasons, but the reason is that you have an obvious question. That is, okay, so something that cannot be eaten raw and is all Shulchan Melech, if a goy cooks it, it's a problem, right? Right. Okay, Rabbi Summers, I just don't understand one thing. I mean, I've been to restaurants which have excellent hashgachas, and it doesn't look like there's people with a beard and payas cooking back there. It looks more like people named Juan are cooking back there. So if Juan is cooking back there, so what gives? How can it be that you're saying there's a halacha of bishlakum, and I don't know, I go to where, I don't want to mention a name, a certain place, and they serve me chicken, and they're serving me steak, and they're serving me all these things, which obviously the food that I'm getting could be served at a banquet, could be served at a state dinner, could be served definitely at a chasana, and I don't see from people working back there. So how's that possible? So the answer is you're right, that Chazal said that if a goy cooks something, it's a problem. But, here's the big but, even if something cannot be eaten raw and is olah shulchan melech, if a Jew is involved with the cooking, even though it's not the entire cooking, as long as a Jew is involved, so then the food is not a problem. Bishlakum, the food is okay. And basically, that's what we work with. A Jew has to be involved, and if a Jew is involved, then even if the food cannot be eaten raw, and even if the food is worthy to be served to a king, the food would still be kosher. The food would still be okay. So now, the big question is, what do you mean involved? What does that mean? What does that mean? Now, obviously, it doesn't mean a Jew has to do everything, or else why do you need the non-Jew? Okay, you know, they could peel things, and okay, that doesn't really help me that much, or it could, but... So what people don't realize is there's a very big argument between Sfardim and Ashkenazim about this issue, about what do you mean involved? A Jew has to be involved. Sfardim, the Machaber holds that Sfardim, and Sfardim hold this way, is that a Jew has to put the pot on the fire. Or, according to many Sfarim, a Jew should stir the pot. Something like that. The question is, Ashkenazim go like the Ramah, who says that a Jew could do less. That the Ramah holds that even if a Jew lit part of the fire, and what do I mean by that, part of the fire? Let's say if a Jew stirred the, right, in the old days used to have coals and things like that, like a barbecue. So if you stir the coals, or bellow the coals, right, you blow on it. In fact, the Darkei Moshe, Ramah, brings down in the Torah, the Darkei Moshe, the Ramah says, if you blow on it with your mouth, not even with a bellows. So we all know that if you blow on a fire, well, on the coals, it will cause it to flare up, right? Now, again, we're not talking about you just like that, you know, didn't really do anything. We're talking about that it caused something to stir. The Shach brings down a famous idea that even if you threw in a small splinter of wood, so what do? You just add it to the fire. That would be good enough. That would be good enough. And from this, we derive that, and most Ashkenazim hold this way, every Ashkenazim hold this way, that if a Jew lit a fire, and a goy lit from that fire, and cooked with the, so to speak, second fire, that would be good also. So the famous case would be, that if a Jew was, sometimes they used to have this in a commercial kitchen, they would have a shiva candle. And the Jew lit the Shiva candle. Now, basically, it lasts for 7 days, right? So now, if the light goes out, if the fire goes out or whatever it is, and the goy lights from the Shiva candle, which the Jew lit, and lights the fire, according to Ashkenazim, that would be okay. Okay, you have a problem. How do you know that the goy really did that? Okay, so let's leave that problem. That obviously the Ashkenazim would have to be on top of. But you get the idea that there is two different opinions of what is considered a Jew being involved. Making part of the fire, is that good enough? Or you have to do more than that? Put the food on, stir the food, make the entire fire. Make the fire. That's what Sfardim would hold. But Ashkenazim hold that could be less. Now, Sfardim in our day and age have a challenge. The challenge is most Hashkochas, especially in America, are by Ashkenazim. And these leniencies I mentioned that are accepted by Ashkenazim, the leniencies, if you want to call that, of the Ramah, the Shach, and the Taz, that you could just throw in a fire, or add to the fire, or blow on the fire, or stir the coals, right? Those are accepted by Ashkenazim, not by Sfardim. So obviously the challenge is, could a Sfardi eat from an Ashkenazi Hashgacha? Now again, in a house it's a less of a problem. But let's say they want to go to a restaurant. So for Sfardim, if a restaurant relies upon the leniencies we mentioned just a couple seconds ago, the Ramah, so according to Sfardim, that's Bishul Aklam. They can't eat that food. So more modern day poskim of Sephardic poskim say that they could rely upon an Ashkenazi Hashgacha. Some say it's best not to, but you have to realize it's an issue. And through my years in Beis Yaakov, there would be sometimes a girl whose father was a Rav who was a Sephardi, and they would tell me things like, you know, when we order, my father goes into the kitchen and puts the food on the fire, or stirs the pot. Or I think one girl told me that when her father orders pizza, that he goes and he shovels it into the, you know, they make it and put on that thing, and my father shovels it into the oven and closes the oven. They would do things like that. But I don't know, I really don't know if many Sfardim are aware of these issues that, you know, I don't know, maybe now some Hashgachos are more careful or have a different standard to accommodate the Sfardim. But this is definitely, definitely, definitely an issue. Okay? Now again, as I said before, so everybody with me so far? Okay? So does that answer the problem of what they do? What they do in a kitchen, you see Juan and Juanita and all these people back there. So this is what they have to do. They have to make sure that the fire was lit by a Jew. Now, in the old days when there were pilot lights, it was a little easier. The Jew lit the pilot. They had to make sure it was... So then if a goy lit from that pilot light, so you could be lenient according to the Ashkenazim. Again, but that's basically what they rely upon, is that somehow a Jew was involved with some of the fire in some way, so then all the food, even though there's no Jew back there doing really anything, but then, at least according to Ashkenazim, that stuff, all that food is Bishul Yisrael. Yeah?
So then, I guess, then obviously Ashkenazim don't have, well, but they have to have a Mashiach Hamidi, so then, this is going to be discussed, but what about all the other aspects of preparing the food, even if it's a
right. There's a separate issue of, like we discussed, I think last week or whatever it was, about what type of hashkacha you need just because of a hashkacha, right? I think it was last week or whatever it was, we discussed about, you know, there's a spectrum of what is recognizes how hard a hashkacha is. So for example, one end of the spectrum, we have like making wine or grape juice. There's a very strict, hard hashkacha. On the other end of the spectrum, we have like giving hashkacha to water, right? Not a hard hashkacha, right? Then the question is things in between. meat is a little more stringent for the reasons we said, like Basar Shnisa Aminayin and all those other things. This type of stuff, right? Water, I don't know if it's all Shulchan Malachim. Meat is. So again, I think I mentioned last week somebody was here from Eretz Yisrael. They were talking to me about, do the Hashkachas in Los Angeles have a Mashgiach Tamidi? Somebody there all the time, but that's what the Mashgiach Tamidi means. Somebody there all the time in the Fleishik establishments. And he told me, it seemed to him, that not every Fleishik establishment had somebody there all the time. He said, in Eretz Yisrael, that's the standard. So we were talking, you know, like, you might not need a Mashgiach Tamidi there all the time for Fleishiks, but I told him I can understand why in Israel they have that. Because there's various, this could be one of them. How about if a fire goes out? How about if, you know, like, you have to be on top of these things. You have to have some fail-safe. I remember I was in an office once we were doing a get, and the office we were in that we were doing the get happened to be an office of somebody who was involved with Kashrus. And they had a memo. This is a few years ago, so it could be they do this now. They had a memo on his table from I forgot whom that they said they were going to have soon that a mashgiach could light a fire in a plant through remote control over many miles. In other words, he could be at home. He knows that they're coming in. They're going to start cooking. I don't know whatever time. Let's say 9 o'clock. I don't know. So at 5 to 9, he pushes a button in his home, and he could be miles away, and that will light the fire in the plant. Now, I don't know, like I said, that was a few years ago. That was a few years ago. I wouldn't be surprised if they're doing that now. Now again, how do you know that the, how do you know maybe there's someone there before? So you're right, they have to cover all those things. I'm just saying, if we just tunnel vision just on this aspect, so now you have a Jew turning on the fire.
Also, I'm referring to the general aspect of preparing the food, which, I mean, what about the massive undertaking of checking for bugs?
Right. You're right. There's all these other. I might cover that last week. And I don't remember. That there are side issues. I think last week I discussed about Debbie marching me into a kitchen of a restaurant and saying, you know, find out how they check, you know, and I had a whole story about that, about how they check for bugs and things. You're right. That's another thing I said people hopefully will walk away with an appreciation of, knowing what is a shaila, appreciating what a hashgacha is, and also knowing what to ask. In other words, what, you know, giving a hashgacha is not just ingredients. They have to cover this. They have to cover bugs. They have to cover Shabbos. They have to cover maybe on Tavasa, you know, so maybe the place... you know, these kosher, they're already well advertising into about Pesach programs here and there and all these type of things. So, the Koganyantiv? Somebody dines at the 545 Minyan. That he's a mashgiach at Cedars. So he said they're cooking, like, way before Purim, they're cooking for Pesach there. Cooking for Pesach. And they have to store it, and how they store it, so it's unbelievable. So these are all issues, right?
What about the microwave? That does not...
No, very good. I was going to get to that at the end, but... see, with a microwave, you get into a separate issue, and that is whether that's considered cooking, as far as Chazal are concerned. Is that considered cooking as far as Chazal are concerned? Because maybe Chazal, we're only referring to fire-like things. There's a microwave included in that. So believe it or not, there is a difference of opinion. Most hashgachas say that microwave is a problem. If a goy would cook covering these with a microwave, it would be a problem. Believe it or not, there is a hashgacha, very well-known hashgacha with a very reliable Talmud Chacham, which most people rely upon, who I heard, and the Rav who runs that hashgacha told me that he holds that microwaves are not a problem. Where this came up, if those who've been in Los Angeles for a while, if you remember when Noah's Bagels was kosher, way back, so what blew the hashgacha, well, they started making sandwiches with pig in it. That was a slight problem. But before that, there was a middle ground that already started to be a problem, and that is they started serving an egg, like an egg on a bagel. An egg on a bagel. And how they did that is they took an egg, and then they put on the bagel, and then they microwaved it. So this was the big problem. Is that bishlakum or not? And there was a big argument in town. Again, the first question is, well, is that cooking? Or is that not cooking as far as kazalah is concerned? So it was a difference of opinion. They were discussing. Then Noah's announced that they're going to serve sandwiches, and then the whole thing was just over anyways. But that was an issue. Now, let's, in the few minutes we got left, as I said before, Bishlakim is very severe, because if someone, again, if Juanita made Shabbos completely kosher, everything fine, kosher ingredients, kosher pots, kosher utensils, kosher everything, not only is the food treif, what we call treif, we use that word, but also the utensils are not kosher anymore. Anything she used, the pots, the pans, which she used to prepare that food, have to be koshered. But, here's the but. The only thing is that by Bishlakim, if a pot is prohibited, I hate to use this word, but only because of Bishlakim, so we're a little more lenient about how you kosher the pots than we are normally. What do I mean by that is that, as you know, normally, this is again, normally we do not kosher ceramic. But let's say if Juanita served the chicken soup, which was bishlakum, in a mug, a ceramic mug. The mug is treif. So normally what do we say by treif mug? We can't do anything for it. Forget it. Can't kosher ceramic. But if the only reason why it's treif is because it came into contact with bishlakum food, we would allow you to kosher it. How you kosher it, again, you have to ask a rabbi, but you'd be allowed to kosher. That's a very big leniency. That's a very big leniency, that we allow you to kosher ceramic if bishlakum was the problem that was involved with the ceramic. Another leniency that we have by bishlakum is by Shabbos. What I mean by that? Let's say there was somebody sick, Chas v'Shalom, on Shabbos. And we're not talking about someone who is in danger, because obviously, you know, if someone, God forbid, is sick on Shabbos and there's a life-threatening situation, then all bets are off, right? You don't have to worry about bishlakum. You don't have to worry about a lot, anything. But let's say someone, Chas v'Shalom, was sick on Shabbos. Not that they were in sakana, not that they were in danger, but let's say they need something cooked for them. Let's say you know, your family used up the chicken soup last night and Shabbos morning, and this person needs chicken soup. So what do? Juanita could do it. Juanita could do it for him. Aye, but besides the Shabbos problem, isn't that bishlakum? So the answer is Chazal didn't make a gzeira in that case. I mean, they didn't. They said the gzeira is off in that case, meaning that even though it is bishlakum, it's something important, and she cooked it completely. Now, again, you obviously have to make sure that's a kosher pot, that's a kosher chicken, that, you know, all those type of things. But let's say it is, like, again, that's what we're talking about. That the goy used perfectly kosher utensils, perfectly kosher food, but still it's a problem. But if they're doing it on Shabbos for somebody who is ill, the ill person could have that food. They can eat that food on Shabbos, right? That's the way Chazal made it. Chazal did not make a gzeira when a person's health is involved. Now, again, we're even not talking about the person's gravely ill, or, you know, we're talking about somebody's ill. So then a goy could cook for them on Shabbos, and that's not a problem with bishlakum. The only thing is, in that case, is two things. First of all, once they made the chicken soup, so now the sick person had the chicken soup, and there's leftover chicken soup. So your teenage boy is going to come over and say, well, can I have the rest? So then the answer is, no, it's bishlakum. It wasn't bishlakum for the second person, for the sick person, rather, for the sick person, but a person who is a bari, a person who is well, is not allowed to have that. And not only that, but after Shabbos, we have to make a new batch of food for the sick person. In other words, we only allow bishul hakom for the sick person and only on Shabbos.
And the pot is okay?
And the pot's okay. The pot's fine. The flour pot's not a problem. Okay? Did I forget anything? Okay, so that's the issue of bishul hakom. Okay, in Meretz Hashem next week, we're going to get into the next mini topic, and that is the issue of Chol V'Yisrael. That's going to be what we're going to Meretz Hashem talk about next week, and maybe a few other things along with that. Okay? Okay? Any questions? Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. This is just a follow-up, if everyone remembers. I'm sure you do, that Mrs. Kronbach did some work for us that, again, she had something ceramic, and she did a test, and she put into one coffee, one soda, one
grape juice,
and she put it into her ceramic kiln, and she did not bring it all, she fired it up, but she didn't let go through the whole cycle like we would normally do, and she took it out in the middle, and if you recall, on the bottom, there was, like, on one of them, that you could really see heavy coffee stains on the bottom. So in other words, this proved the idea of something that taste is absorbed inside the vessel. Because when she fired it up, even though she cleaned it, it was clean. But still, it looked perfectly clean. It looked like this, I would dare say. But then, when she fired it up, it got all dirty on the bottom. The taste, the coffee taste, the grape juice taste, the soda taste, whatever it was.
Yes.
Yeah, the soda. It was stained. And as we saw last week, on the coffee one, it was like really dark, completely dark on the bottom. So this week, what she did in the meantime is she took them back and ran through a whole cycle.
Right, they've been fired to 1,100.
1,100 degrees. Before it was just only 600 degrees. Really cool. Yeah. So now, if you look at all of them, we can't even tell which one's which. Because they're all gone.
So, may I summarize what I was told in terms of the kashering is that by firing it to the 1100, I've now remade them.
It's closer to kibshon, we call it. It went back into the furnace. Right.
So
that proves it. See? Gone. Right? Yeah. It's gone. It's completely gone. So we don't always do this, but in certain cases, like I think sometimes people come to her, to Mrs. Kronbach, because they could have, you know, they might have parents or grandparents who are not from, and they have, you know, some china that came over on the Mayflower, and it has a lot of...
I've gotten that really scary. It's like, this is the 200-year-old dishes.
Is that me?
It's me.
Oh, okay. I thought nobody was reacting, so I was beginning to think about me. From somewhere. Yeah, no, so like again, you have to speak to a Rav, when could you do this and when you can't, but again, it shows the concept of something absorbed inside. Like I used to say in Beis Yaakov, like little pigs running around inside. You don't see the pigs, but the pigs are running around inside, and people question that, especially in our society, you know, I don't see anything. So here we see that there's something there even though you don't see it.
Well, like the coffee one is especially because it could be Bears, cream with the coffee.
All right.
You're now going to turn that into
that's right. Plastic. And that's a great segue to next week because we're going to talk about Chol V'Yisrael and milk and powdered milk and okay, we'll get into it next week, Polina. Okay, thank you for coming.
Thank you.